I have named this talk The Wayfinding Mind. And now, at the risk of giving you the idea that you are in the wrong place of worship this Sunday morning, I will start by quoting the Bible, King James Version. The quote is from the 7th chapter of the Gospel of Matthew. It is taken from verse 7 in the New Testament and part of the Sermon on the Mount. It reads, "Seek, and ye shall find. Knock, and it shall be opened unto you." Again, "Seek, and ye shall find. Knock, and it shall be opened unto you." I've been very drawn to the connection between seeking and finding, and will tell you why. Many of you have heard the personal stories of how various Sangha members made their way to this practice in their way-seeking mind talks. For anyone who is new or newer here, way-seeking mind talks are the talks given by various Sangha members who have studied the precepts and attained lay ordination or jukai. They get to speak to the Sangha as I am speaking to you today. A way-seeking mind talk is an opportunity for the now ordained to tell their story, share how they found or made their way to Zen practice, and in general, to establish a level of intimacy with members of the Sangha. As you look around the room, you will notice a number of us wearing this bib-like item called a rakusu. It is a miniature version of Buddha's robe. In the beautiful Jukai ceremony, each participant, or so to speak, graduates of this study, receives a Dharma name. Their Dharma name is recorded on the back of the rakusu that they have hand sewn stitch by stitch in a mindful and contemplative way. This is my rakusu, and my Dharma name is Jakushin. In Japanese, it means serene forest. From my experience and from what I know of the lives of others, receiving Jukai is momentous and life-altering. While studying the precepts some 5 years ago, I remember a Sangha friend telling me that life will not be the same after Jukai. Yet, while the way-seeking mind talk is an opportunity for us to share how we got to this practice, there is no formal way of sharing our post-Jukai lives or the way our lives have unfolded. I ask you, therefore, is a way-finding mind talk not a logical sequel to a way-seeking mind talk? I think it is. Because the depth and breadth of the Zen practice is so profound, as was predicted, life is not the same after Jukai. So this is why I'm calling this my way-finding mind talk. It is my attempt to recognize Buddha's way by sharing my experiences and what I have found or received from my practice. And I marvel how every day in this practice is an opportunity to deepen our practice, and how it presents me with topics for Dharma talks. The seeds for this talk were planted while I was on vacation in New Zealand a year ago, and my brother-in-law Adam gave me a book entitled Wayfinding Leadership. Wayfinding Leadership. It is the text for a leadership course given to the senior executives of Air New Zealand based on the navigating principles of wayfinding. Wayfinding is the ancient Polynesian practice of navigating the open seas using deep knowledge and intense observation of celestial bodies in the sky, the swells of water and nature. It completely predates all modern navigational aids, including the compass, sextant, and certainly GPS, radar, and sonar. A variety of special watercraft were developed over millennia to carry wayfinders around the world. What appealed to me about this book was not a course in leadership, but a fascination of the simplicity yet effectiveness of the principles of traditional Polynesian wayfinding. Yes, I have an interest in marine navigation, having served as a marine search and rescue volunteer for 8 years. Yet, it was the Maori wisdom and perspective of this practice and the universality of the values and principles behind it that captured my attention. Traditional Polynesian navigation was used for thousands of years to make long voyages across vast expanses of open Pacific Ocean. Navigators traveled to small inhabited islands using wayfinding techniques and knowledge passed by oral traditions from master to apprentice, often in the form of song. Aotearoa, or New Zealand, was settled by navigators from Polynesia about 1250 CE. While this book is about the Polynesian method of navigation, it is written from the Maori perspective of wayfinding and uses some Maori terms. Waka, for example, is a Maori name for the New Zealand ocean-going catamaran that is in the forefront of modern wayfinding. The word way has had a special meaning for me, special inference for me for as long as I can remember. For some reason, I have associated it with a dynamic, impassioned spiritual journey. I'm reminded of the Way of the Cross from the Catholic tradition, and book titles such as The Way of the Peaceful Warrior, The Way of Kings, The Way of Zen. I also visualize the journey of the wayfarer, such as Christian in John Bunyan's The Pilgrim's Progress, traveling on foot and step by step, facing up to the temptations and challenges and evils along the way. While wayfinding is a way of navigating the ocean, our spiritual practice is a way of navigating the seas of samsara. From reading the first few pages in the book, I was amazed to find similarities between wayfinding and our Zen practice. Both practices require awareness and attentiveness, quietly responding to and accepting things as they are. As we apply the basics of Buddhism to our daily lives, the seafarers apply parallel skills to navigating the seas. I could not help but notice the similarity of underlying principles of both and essentially how relevant they are to life on the planet today. With planet Earth under siege, gasping from pollution, with groups of life forms becoming extinct daily before our very eyes, and global warming at a tipping point, I beg to ask, how far down the list of species going to extinction is the Homo sapien? I sometimes feel trapped between doing everything possible to avert or at least decelerate the crisis on one hand, and on the other hand, to fully embrace the uncomfortable aspect of impermanence, knowing that the sun, the earth, and civilization, as we know it, will one day be extinct. Deep down, I know that both seeming choices are to be engaged with as part of my practice. Another part of my relationship to wayfinding is that the details of the required skills are evidence that what we strive for and stand for are closely related to the values of the indigenous peoples of the world. Buddhist values are not an oddity, but part of a beautiful, bigger picture of the world, made up of interdependent and interwoven relationships. Some of the first encounters of Polynesian navigation methods and their ships by European explorers are contained in the journals of Captain James Cook and his contemporary, Louis-Antoine de Bougainville, who also explored the South Pacific. Cook noted the estimated traveling speed of the Waka, the Maori name for the twin-hulled sailing ships, to be 22 knots. quite noteworthy since the European sailing ships averaged 2 to 5 knots. De Bougainville commented on their maneuverability by noting that the small outrigger Waka sailed around his ships with the same ease as if we had been at anchor. I'll give you more details later. First, I want to tell you a story to illustrate the skill sets and knowledge of Polynesian navigators. It is the story of Tupaia, an indigenous Tahitian priest, artist, and navigator who sailed with Captain Cook on the maiden voyage of the sailing ship Endeavour. A clash broke out between the two. Cook, a skilled captain, was equipped with a sextant, almanac, compass, along with all the latest navigation aids. Tupaia, reading merely natural signs such as stars, currents, cloud formation, color, and the flight path of birds, warns Cook to change course. Cook repeatedly ignores Tupaia, and sure enough, the Endeavour runs into the reef. Having a technical and engineering background, I was interested in the design of the Waka as a man-made device, especially how they were able to withstand rough seas and make repeated trips to destinations 500 nautical miles apart. What intrigued me more was the human skills required to navigate using embodied, non-cerebral, seemingly intuitive knowledge. Polynesian exploration using wayfinding methods goes back to long before European explorers began to circumnavigate the world. For example, Polynesians first landed in Hawaii over 1600 years ago. While it has been practiced as a highly refined system of perception, wayfinding almost became extinct. Many peoples along the Pacific were prevented from sailing their waka by church missionaries and settler governments under the guise of protecting the natives for their own good. Wayfinding, viewed with suspicion and misunderstanding, was prohibited. It was considered too dangerous and resulted in corroding freedom, self-sufficiency, and the know-how of the people. And with more and more imported food, there was less need for wayfinding to feed the people. In spite of social upheaval and near extinction, the wayfinder's philosophy of being has survived. Polynesian navigators have pulled the threads of a frayed fabric together to recover their wayfinding traditions and to bring them into modern use. Just as Buddha's teachings were transmitted orally for the first 500 years, wayfinding knowledge passed on orally from one generation to the next for centuries, from master to apprentice. Much credit for the current revival is given to Micronesian master navigator Mau Pielug, who has dedicated his life to helping peoples of the Pacific recover wayfinding into a flourishing, dynamic craft of non-instrument navigating. Respectfully known as Papa Mau, Pielug was born on the Carolina Islands, a widely scattered archipelago of tiny islands in the western Pacific Ocean to the north of New Guinea. The international revival of wayfinding was launched some 40 years ago when Pielug offered to sail a boat from Hawaii to Tahiti, a distance of 2,500 miles. The following is taken from the obituary section of The Economist when Pielug died in 2010 at the age of 78. And it reads, "In the spring of 1976, Mau Pielug offered to sail a boat from Hawaii to Tahiti. The expedition was organized by the Polynesian Voyaging Society to see if ancient seafarers could have gone that way through open ocean. The boat was beautiful, a double-hulled canoe named Hokulea, or Star of Gladness. And there was no, but there was no one to captain her. At that time, Mao was the only man who knew the ancient Polynesian art of sailing by the stars, the feel of the wind, and the look of the sea. So he stepped forward. As a Micronesian, he did not know the waters or the winds around Tahiti, far southeast. But he had an image of Tahiti in his head. He knew that if he aimed for that image, he would not get lost. And he never did, that is, get lost. More than 2,000 miles out, a flock of small white terns skimmed across Hokulea heading for the still invisible Mateva Atoll next to Tahiti. Mao knew that the voyage was almost over. That voyage proved that the migration of peoples from the south and west to Hawaii was not an accident. More probably, it was the deliberate act of superlative sea and starcraft. The voyage transformed the self-image of Hawaiians, and it changed Mao's life. On that month-long trip, he carried no compass, sextant, or charts. He was not against modern instruments on principle. A compass could have been useful had he entered an open area of water, an area where could have been useful. That'd be useful to get my pages in order. Would have been useful in daylight, and at least in old age he wore a chunky watch. And I'm continuing the reading from The Economist here, from the obituary. But Mao did not operate on latitude, longitude, angles, or mathematical calculations of any kind. He walked and sailed under the arching web of stars, moving slowly east to west from the arriving, the stars moving slowly east to west from their rising to their setting points, and he knew them so well, more than 100 of them by name, and their associated stars by color, light, and habit, that he seemed to hold the whole cosmos in his head, with himself determined, stocky, and assuming at the nub of the celestial action. A distinguishing feature of a wayfinder's craft is the use of the whole body as a perceptive instrument, attuning to the changing and often seemingly imperceptible signs of nature. Theirs is a disciplined way of using all their senses and different types of intelligence. Cerebral intellect, ancestral wisdom, emotional intelligence, and creative intelligence are all engaged to truly see what is going on, and to process, understand, and discern the relationships of it all. Many have reported how Papa Mao Pelug would lie in the hull of the Waka, where it was the most sensitive to conducting interspersing frequencies formed by various swells and currents, to feel them pass close to his body in order to gauge location. For example, a gently curving beach would send out much weaker waves than a shore hemmed by rocky cliffs. From my service with the Royal Canadian Marine Search and Rescue, I've had one vivid experience in that regard that I did not fully comprehend at the time. It occurred one evening while I was at the helm of the Iona Sea, which is our SAR boat, returning from a rescue mission coming out the bottom end of Agamemnon Channel between Nelson Island and the mainland. The sun was setting, and it was an idyllic time to experience the joy of being on the water in a comfortable and fast boat that I did not have to own or pay for fuel, one of the few perks of volunteering. As we came into open water, I noticed a gentle yet steady nudging of the boat from the starboard side. Observing this sensation with curiosity, I noticed it fade away to a gentle caress, the nudging which was became a gentle caress, soon to be replaced by a nudging from the port side of the boat. I also noticed that both nudgings were of a different frequency and intensity, and that neither affected the boat's course. Then I remembered that I had entered an open area of active water, an area where massive volumes of water converged and diverged with tide and current from and into three directions. It was only in discovering wayfinding that I realized the significance of the experience. Little did I know that the ocean was speaking, communicating so clearly and giving me my first lesson in wayfinding. And I wasn't listening. I didn't need to, because I was navigating visually and I was in known waters. Most of all, I couldn't hear, because all my training had been instrument-based. I knew nothing of wayfinding. In seeking to understand wayfinding, I remembered a quote from one of Kate's recent Dharma talks, and I offer it outside of its original context because its words speak so clearly to the kind of spirituality and even sacredness I believe exists in wayfinding. In her talk, Kate quoted from a book called Learning to Die, Wisdom in the Age of Climate Crisis by scholar poets Robert Bringhurst and Jens Zawicki, who live on Quadra Island. Quoting Zawicki, was writing about understanding beyond rational spiritualism. Understanding beyond rational spiritualism. It seems to require a kind of knowing that is deeper, bone deep, deeper than intellectual knowledge of facts, a knowledge felt in our living, breathing bodies and generated by paying attention. Mr. Wicke continues, and in turn quotes the French philosopher, mystic and activist Simone Weil. Attention, taken to its highest degree, is the same as prayer. It presupposes faith and love. Absolutely unmixed attention is prayer. I ask myself if this profound and deeply personal sense of prayer lives on in me from my earlier Catholic tradition. Then again, how could prayer be absent from wayfinding when one is so timelessly and intimately connected and surrendered to our first mother, the sea? Wayfinding sailing techniques were so effective that these small ships so sturdy that they made regular trips to the same destinations. As previously stated, the waka are catamarans built to withstand the rigors. Their hulls, or bodies, are a metaphor for the container of values. They contain and hold the values. The hull is the part of the waka that enables it to float. And in sailing forth, lines up with the star path, luminaries, swells, and the wind. Values are not presented as singular, abstract, or standalone ideals that don't relate to one another. Wayfinding values, like the precepts in our practice, make up an interlocking system that makes up the whole. Each value or precept illuminates a dimension of relationship that can only be understood in relation to other values or precepts. Following is a list of values to cultivate to be a wayfinder. Notice how similar they are to those of our practice. First one is humility. There is a Maori proverb that translates to the kumara, which is sweet potato, does not say how sweet it is. One with humility is more likely to speak of the contributions of others and deflect attention from their own. If what you have done has made a difference, it will speak louder. Then, next requirement is personal sovereignty, kindness, and generosity. Each person is a thread in the fabric of a community, each lending their own specialness, expertise, and effort. It starts by being effective or a leader in one's own life. having certain and individual disciplines that support one's personal life leads to kindness and generosity. Then there's belonging is stressed. In a nutshell, have group awareness. Example, unless there is a designated group leader or event planner, each person looks around to see what needs to be done and joins in. This is in contrast to asking, what can I do? And just picking up a tea towel and starting to dry dishes. Somewhat sheepishly, I'm reminded of what I've had to learn and even still do in this arena. Stewardship and guardianship. A relational belonging at the heart of Maori culture extends to a sense of kinship with all creation. This sense expresses itself in an interesting way when Maori introduce themselves. Unlike Western protocol, where a person will first give their name, Maori will begin by identifying genealogical connection to many relationships, referencing their sacred mountains, oceans, rivers, ancestors, ancestral home tribe, sub-tribe, and family. And probably takes quite a while to introduce themselves. One's name is the last thing mentioned. It is their way of ordering the world and their connection with it. As understood by most indigenous peoples, we breathe the same air as plants and animals. The exhalation of one element becomes the life force inhaled by another. Spirituality. The spiritual and material dimensions of Maori life are woven together through karakia, which is an incantation to invocation. A karakia, unlike Western prayer, invokes a reality. As an example, a karakia declares peace, whereas a prayer asks for, maybe even pleads for peace. Karakia is also described as a mindful conversation that strengthens resilience, fortitude, and courage, much more than a fear-based reaction in uncertain times. In addition to having values, there are a number of practices that a wayfinder must cultivate. Each practice is a whole section unto itself, and the following is my summary of each. Read the signs. This practice stresses awareness, alertness, and attentiveness. In this story, several young men on the waka with him came to Papa Mau, concerned about a bird they saw one day, saying, according to the book we read, these birds should not be in this place. Papa Mau replied, maybe the bird hasn't read your book. And his point here is to caution them not to get caught up with what books and theories say, and to pause and consider new and current possibilities. Next one, move from stillness. Here, as in Zazen, stillness is stressed. The value of meditation as mindfulness is stressed. It is deemed essential for wayfinders to operate from a relaxed state in all circumstances, whether in a raging storm or caught up in the wayward and dangerous winds of the doldrums. To attain this level of equanimity, the meditation practice of Nobopuku is described. Nobopuku is sitting with something deep in the belly. We can move from this mode of belly repose, calmness, despite any turbulence on the surface of our lives, be it a natural disaster or emotional turmoil. An addition to meditation is the practice of reflexivity. Reflexivity, as an active practice, is the capacity to step back and reflect and challenge one's own thinking, letting go of assumptions, norms, and habits that prevent us from seeing what is going on around us. Listen for differences. I like this one a lot. It is essentially a listening practice. It describes active listening even beyond the practice reflective listening, where one gets to repeat back what has been said. The kind of listening that is required is the kind that will enable dialogue. Dialogue is in contrast to discussion. Discussion is behind most forms of listening in our fast-paced world. Etymologically, dialogue evolves from two Latin words which translated into flow of meaning. That's dialogue. Discussion, on the other hand, evolves from two other Latin words, and in the 15th century, their English meaning was a taking over, a debate. So from their Latin roots, strike asunder or break up, and smash or shake apart, it would seem, therefore, that a flow of meaning conversation would be more desirable than a strike asunder, shake, smash type of conversation. Adapt to change. This practice encapsulates our understanding of impermanence, the rejection of which is also a non-acceptance of change. When a journalist asked Papa Mao what it was like to be lost, the reply was he had never been lost. The Western concept of lost is quite unlike the wayfinders. If we don't know our position, we presume we are lost. We have a pervasive sense needing to know where we are all the time. I guess just as I need to know what time it is when I wake up at night. I quote from Alice in Wonderland for a lighthearted, slightly skewed perspective on change. It's no use going back to yesterday, because I was a different person then. Shed resistance. Another practice that I found insightful challenges the notion that resistance is bad. I can think of many things to resist in our practice. The Zafus aren't very comfortable. Long hours of Zazen. Learning Orioki. And all that bowing. Instead, it is important to know that resistance is important. While resistance is an indicator of what needs to be done, it can also arise as a reaction to change. Yet, if we cling to what is familiar in wayfinding, our mental models, habits, and routines can prevent us from seeing what is really going on. To sharpen our senses, this practice is one to be adopted with awareness and discernment. We must be present in the moment and trust our gut. Learn by doing. Practice. Not unlike within our Sangha, wayfinders are encouraged to acquire both a breadth and depth of practice. In wayfinding, knowledge is a verb, not a noun. It is a living act of creation. Wayfinding involves the knowledge to be able to do stuff, learning by doing, then repeatedly testing that knowledge. A Maori proverb that expresses that perspective is, what I read, I forget. What I see, I remember. And what I do, I know. I know that there is a similarity between learning by doing and finding as well in our, and wayfinding as well in our Zen practice. My time is up, and I must confess that the material covered today was intended to be the first third of today's talk. I got carried away with it. So interesting. Somehow it grew to take up all the allotted time, so if appropriate, I can do the second part of my wayfinding mind talk at some later date. To close, I will read a quote from Antoine de Saint-Exupéry, the beloved French author of The Little Prince and Night Flight. And he writes, "If you want to build a ship, don't drum up people to collect wood, and don't assign them tasks and work, but rather teach them to long for the endless immensity of the ocean." I've come up with a Zen version of this, and I offer it as, if you want to build a temple, don't ask people to collect bricks and don't assign them tasks and work, but rather teach them to long for the endless immensity of Buddha's way. This opportunity to speak before you has been helped me immensely in my practice, and I sit here with gratitude and thank you.